Well, you were right in the first place, Jim. It is about Memorial Day, and it is about war and peace. It's been about 5 years since I shared this piece that I had in my first book, and I want to share it again because I think it speaks to the condition of so many of my generation. Spoke a little differently to the greatest generation, and maybe it's something that the current generation needs to think about. It's called Our Wailing Wall. I was actually, the introduction to this is I was doing a minister on loan program where they send Unitarian Universalist ministers into the missionary work among the heathen, and or they send heathen to do missionary work among the civilized. I don't know, but they send me from California to Vero Beach, Florida, to tame the golf courses in the area. And on the way back, I visited Washington, D.C. I had to visit the Vietnam War Memorial. I had to see those names, those 55,000 names carved into the black marble. Vietnam is my war, the war of my generation, the war that called me to fight. Like many of my time and class, I fought against the war while others went to fight. I needed to see the names of those who did not come back. In the old days, the wealthy and the privileged could avoid the draft. For a payment of money, they could hire someone to fight. Such days, I'd always believed, were in the long dead past. As I visited the memorial, I realized how wrong I was. Money, class, and privilege can still buy one's way out. Another year of graduate school, a good and cooperative doctor, a psychiatrist, a lawyer, and ultimately, if absolutely necessary, a travel agent. I went to school, to the Peace Corps, to seminary, while others went to NAM. I am not filled with guilt at my choices, educational, political, or ethical. What I did, I would do again. I am filled with pain for those who did not have real choices, real options. I am filled with pain because I know that these 55,000 names are not simply names. They are real people, some men, some women, but mostly boys. As a parent, I sense the inexpressible loss and grief. How can we begin to understand the true magnitude of such pain? 100,000 parents, how many sisters, brothers, wives, children, lovers? No, those are not names on that black marble wall. They are people. They are stories. This monument is quite unique. Instead of celebrating the glories of war with mock heroic statuary or the usual phallic pillars, needles, and obelisks, this is a deep gash invaginated into the living earth. One does not behold the Vietnam Memorial. One enters into it. One descends into this V-shaped embrace of marble and earth. These names, these people, these stories are not hidden in shame, but returned to the earth, the clay, the dust. This is not a place of glory or heroism. It is a place of comfort. It is maternal, a womb-like accepting of our grief and our tears. People leave flowers at the base of a particular slab, which bears the name of a son or father or husband or lover. People write notes and stick them into the seams in the marble slabs, just as religious Jews leave notes and prayers in Jerusalem's wailing wall. Perhaps this is part of the magic of this memorial. It is our wailing wall, a place for our tears, a place for our serious thoughts about war, glory, pain, and history. Just up from the marble, cast in bronze, are a black man, a white, and a Latino. Instead of looking proud and brave in their dress uniforms, they seem to gaze back at the wall with an almost palpable sadness as they stand there frozen in their aptly named fatigues. I look back to follow their view, and I see this deep black gash. What an apt visual metaphor for the Vietnam War. Yet here the gas does not separate. The earth smells of life. The walls seem to welcome the names. The names make real the terrible cost of war. For the dead, it doesn't matter who was right or wrong, hawk or dove. For the dead, it doesn't matter whether it was a good cause or a bad cause or a lost cause. They were called. They obeyed. They died. They are dead, and they deserve to be remembered, and they deserve to be mourned. This warm embrace welcomes us and beckons us to remember and learn. The song asks, when will we ever learn? And I don't know. I don't know. I know that we as human beings have so much rage and violence and fear. I know that it's easy and romantic, as many people often do, to blame government and say the governments have fight wars. The people don't fight wars. People are good and governments fight those wars. But while it is true that governments and political causes can whip people into a frenzy, people are awfully good at being whipped into a frenzy without government. Government sometimes just becomes another thing to blame for what we don't want to look at inside. Sometimes, and I got a letter this week about religion as the cause of war, and there's no doubt government is a cause of war. Religion is a cause of war, one of the great organizing principles, one of the uniforms that we wear in order to justify our wars, in order to rally the troops up, in order to give our lives and our deaths a greater sense of purpose, because it's not simply for me and it's not simply for loot, it's for God and goodness. The world is a Manichaean place. We divide into good and evil, where we are the good and they are the evil. And it's one of the things that human beings do. I often heard various times in my life that if we only got rid of religion and had good therapy and drugs, we would not go to war. It's not true. Secular systems kill with as much enthusiasm as religious systems, and drugs are not necessarily the answer. My generation tried that, and as you all know, I'm sure, the word assassin comes from hashish, and they used to get their troops stoned and then have them go off into war. So not even grass is the answer to the violence that is in the human being. There aren't easy answers. We look today at the cultural wars that are going on, and wars so much a metaphor. We talk about war. In some ways, we've both cheapened war and obliterated the concept of war. We have wars on poverty. We fight cultural wars. But we have not had, as Americans, a declared war since World War II. So I guess we don't have any war dead since World War II, since Korea was a police action and Vietnam was, I'm still not sure, and Grenada and Lebanon and Iraq and Afghanistan, oh, that's the war on terrorism. Again, an undeclared war. We have blurred the legalities, we have blurred the moralities, and we want to point to the bad guys. It's the government, it's the greed, it's the oil, it's if we could only have a victory by the secularists in this cultural war. I think that we have to stop and look at ourselves and look at what war achieves, what it doesn't achieve, and what our impulses are. I know this sounds like a terrible re-imaging of the NRA's guns don't kill people, people kill people, but you know something? People kill people. We are easily put into rage against the other. Rage and violence against the other. But it is not hopeless. We look at what happened in Rwanda and we see people whipped up into a frenzy and Hutu killing Tutsi and Tutsi killing Hutu. We see people whipped up into a frenzy in differences that we cannot really imagine or understand between Sunni and Shia. How crazy can it be? They're the same religion. Well, how crazy was all the killing between Trinitarian and Arian over the nature of the Trinity and whether or not Jesus was just like God or was God? And this was done over linguistics? I hardly think so. Changing linguistics won't end war. We could just as easily say language causes war. What causes war is human beings. And war and violence is part of what made us human beings. And we deny that at the peril of reality. Because I believe that we cannot fix problems that we are not willing to confront honestly. I am filled with violence and rage all the time. Ask my wife. No, I don't take it out on her, but she hears me behind the wheel. I use names for other drivers who cut me off, who sit there on the telephone when the light changes, who are weaving back and forth as they're trying to dial a number while steering with their knees, if at all, down a winding street. And I have unkind things to say to them. And I would say it if they weren't already on the telephone. And I knew their number. I'm filled with violence, but I haven't been in a fist fight since junior high school. Now, that doesn't make me a better person than anyone else, and that's not quite true. I haven't been in an unsupervised fist fight since junior high school. I was on the boxing team in college. I never met a left hook that could not find my nose. Gave up a promising career as a punching bag to go into the clergy, and I thought it was different. Anyway, as Humphrey Bogart says in Casablanca, I was misinformed. I have all of this violence that I don't use. That's not a pity. That's not a shame. We, on a day-to-day basis, can choose not to be violent against our impulses, against our urges. You know, one of the things that we see so often out, and let's talk about something that's easier to talk about than violence, let's talk about sex. We understand that you can't deal sexually with issues of repression. It pops out. You can't deal with issues of violence unless you're willing to confront the fact that we come from predator backgrounds, that we are the by definition the survivors. We are the descendants of the people who won, who are descendants of the animals that won, who are descendants of those who evolved the quickest in order to be able to see, to move, to think, to cooperate, who understood quickest the social contract. The social contract was, look, I can kill the rat by myself, but if I'm going to get the mammoth and the whole tribe's going to survive, then I'm going to have to give up part of my autonomy to you so that you'll help me kill the mammoth. And I have to give up some of the mammoth to you so that we're going to both share and survive, and our families and our tribes will survive and share. So we learned to cooperate. We learned a social contract. We learned to build weapons. We learned to use weapons to bring down things that were bigger and faster and stronger than we were. We studied war. And we learned how to fight, and we learned how to cooperate, and that's part of how we got here. But now what? those adaptations and those survival skills and that genius for cooperation, for tool building, for weapon building, those great poems and epics and sagas that celebrated all of those manly virtues of war, of sacrifice, of violence, all of those things may not be as useful when we have a technology now that doesn't really take all of the time a lot of courage to push a button, to be able to discern the difference between a video game that takes out electrons on a screen or that takes out and kills human beings. Now, I wish I could say, and I wish that I had the strength of character and the faith to be able to say, the answer is just no more war. We're just going to learn the lesson. But I can't say that. Some can, but I can't say that. Because there are times when apparently you have to defend yourself, and you have to defend your tribe, your people, your nation. There are monsters in the world, and there are mobs in the world, and I wish that people of conscience could just all stand and say no. But maybe you can do that when the opposition has stones. It's harder to do when it is bombs. But it's terribly difficult and morally complex. Look at the wars that we have fought and won. I love talking about the American Revolutionary War, because if we had lost that, we'd all be speaking English today, and instead of Spanish as God means us to. Did you know the word filibuster is from filibustero? It means to freeboot, to grab. It actually comes from the word booty. Yes, that booty also, what you're cackling about, is something that you want and you grab that you may not be entitled to, and you hold, such as the podium in the case of the filibuster. But that's a digression. So we won that war. We won the Revolutionary War, and we lost the War of 1812, and sometimes we fight wars, and sometimes human beings fight wars about things that make absolutely no sense at the time and make less sense 50 years later, 100 years later, 1,000 years later. And as humans, we just go, what were we thinking? But there are also times when there is monstrous evil. And how do you oppose it? And how do you know how to oppose it and to what level? And it's much too easy across the religious and the political spectrum. This does not fall by ideology to say by any means necessary, it's so important, we have to prevail no matter what the damage. My plea is for all of us to look deep inside at the truth of humanity, of our heritage, of our cleverness, of what has brought us to this moment, and think seriously about what steps we take to know when to hold them and when to fold them, to know when to be caught up in the drums that would beat, that would let all of the adrenaline, the epinephrine of rage go. And when we can, fighting all of those instincts, say, no, not today. Or if today, not with hatred, not with self-righteousness, not with a sense that it is a holy act to engage in this kind of war, but to remember the real costs in real human beings and pain and suffering and loss. I believe, and it is an article of faith, not of knowledge, along with Anne Frank, that most human beings are basically good. Most human beings in America, most Republicans, most Democrats, most Sunni, most Shia, most Orthodox, most fundamentalists, most evangelicals, most Catholics, most Buddhists, most Hindus are basically good. All over the world, I have found love and acceptance and hospitality, regardless of race, color, or creed. But I'm not willing to do the easy bifurcation, the people are good and the governments are bad, because the people, we the people, also can be whipped into a frenzy of that rush of anger and hatred, that frenzy that I feel from time to time, but as an act of will, say, no, not today. I am not frightened by my anger. I am not frightened by the full spectrum of my humanity, but the fact that I accept it is the first step towards being able to make an informed decision without passion and prejudice. Doesn't guarantee it's going to be the right decision. I can't read the future. But it will be an informed and moral decision as best as I can make it. I was talking to a group a couple of weeks ago, and I used the Anne Frank example again. And somebody sitting in the second row said, yeah, but Anne Frank died. She was killed. That's true. But I didn't mean it to come out funny, but I guess it came out funny. We remember the ones that kill us, not the thousands who accept us, who love us, who feed us, who take care of us. We remember the ones who throw the bombs, who fire the guns, who set off the improvised explosive devices, the ones who do the terrible things. But that is not all of humanity. We may remember our own angry impulses, but that is not all of us. We are better than our worst impulses, and humanity is better than its most angry and violent and destructive people. Memorial Day, it's more than an automobile race. It's more than an excuse for a sale at the department stores and a picnic. It's a time to remember what got us to this moment where we have choices to make. It's a time to remember the cost, the real cost of war. It's a time to remember the power that we have to choose, to say yes, as sometimes perhaps we must, or to say no, as sometimes I believe we have to. It's a time to think and to choose and to take responsibility for what we do in this beautiful world together.